Great. Thank you, Ted, and thanks to all of you. I'm thoroughly enjoying this visit, and I thank you for the invitation to come and speak here. I have called this talk on rabbits, foxes, clouds, and rain, and hopefully by the end of this you will have an idea of why I've given it that title. Brief acknowledgement to my co-conspirator, Ilan Koren at the Weizmann Institute, who has worked with me closely on many of these issues. The climate system is a very complex system. This is essentially what drives a lot of research in our field. How is the climate changing? The climate system is a tightly coupled system. It comprises different elements, each of which has a huge amount of complexity. If you dig deeply into the atmospheric system, the ocean system, or any one of these, you can spend more than a lifetime on any part of this system. We are primarily interested in the atmosphere, and in my case, we are mostly interested in the clouds. Clouds, if you look at this picture of the planet, clearly stand out as changing the albedo, the reflectance of this system. You can see these bright white clouds against the dark ocean surface. You can also see some of the brighter desert regions. But clearly, clouds are playing a very large role in determining the reflectance of this planet. And so our desire is to try to understand how clouds will change in a changing climate. And in my particular case, we're interested in understanding how aerosol particles, suspended particles in the air, will be changing the brightness or the reflectance of these clouds. This is a ship track image for those in the field of aerosol cloud interaction, satellite imagery. This is a very common image. It's essentially showing these bright linear features. What are they? They're essentially showing you ship tracks. Ships are moving underneath at the surface, at the ocean surface. They're emitting particles. Those particles are getting locked up in the cloud. They're locking up the droplets in small sizes, and they are more reflective. So the higher the concentration of aerosol particles, the brighter the cloud will be. And so these aerosol particles are modifying the reflectance of clouds. So we're interested in clouds to begin with. Are there clouds there? Because the very existence of a cloud changes the planetary albedo. But then we're all also interested in whether these suspended particles might modify the reflectance of the cloud. With apologies to Professor List, I have to just give a few brief introductory slides to cloud physics. This is very brief and very simple, but these are some simple underlying ideas that you'll need to follow the rest of the discussion. The first point I need to make is that drops form on tiny suspended particles. These are those aerosol particles, and I've shown them as these little black dots embedded inside the droplets. Typically, larger drops form on larger aerosol particles. That's simply because the more soluble material you have, the easier it is to make a larger drop. And so, all else equal, the more aerosol particles you have, the more abundant and smaller drops you will have. Just for scale, cloud drops are microns to millimeters in size, and aerosol particles are less than a micron. They could be just small clusters at the size of about a few nanometers, but all the way up to perhaps a couple of microns, but typically less than a micron in size. The other fundamental piece of cloud microphysics, at least in liquid clouds, warm clouds, is that drop coalescence generates rain. So the condensation growth of particles is not going to give you a raindrop. You need to have collector drops, fairly large drops with a significant fall velocity, falling through the background cloud and collecting these smaller cloud droplets. The coalescence efficiency between these drops is a strong function of size. Well, and we just pointed out that aerosol particles will determine the size of cloud droplets. Therefore, you can start seeing the complexity of the system just at the very superficial level. If I were to try to summarize that into one very brief slide, it would say if I have few aerosol particles, I'm going to have larger drops and I'm going to tend to have more precipitation, all else equal, than if I had lots of aerosol particles, lots of small drops. My coalescence between the drops is going to be less efficient, and I'm unlikely to grow raindrops. The upshot of this is that a cloud which has just a few large drops is not going to be nearly as reflective as a cloud that has lots of smaller droplets and that formed on those numerous aerosol particles. And there again is that demonstration of the satellite image. These ship tracks have got the ship effluent in them, the aerosol particles that polluted the cloud, if you like, formed lots of small droplets, prevented the precipitation, and created those bright linear features. Now, why do we care about this? Just to show you some numbers, here is a chart from the AR4 assessment. This is the IPCC assessment report number 4. If you look at the carbon dioxide forcing, this is the greenhouse gas forcing, CO2, methane, and various other gases are giving you a forcing of a few positive few watts per meter squared. Here is the cloud forcing, the cloud albedo effect. This is aerosol particles modifying the microphysics of clouds, and it's negative. It's counteracting this greenhouse gas warming. There is a huge uncertainty associated with this forcing. This is what we're trying to narrow down. Well, you can see that this is an incredibly complex problem. We need to study aerosol cloud precipitation interactions and all the feedbacks at a huge range of scales, from the scale of small micron-sized particles, turbulent clouds, convection, all the way to the global scale. So we've got ranges from microns to thousands of kilometers. The timescales run from seconds or even less than that if you're thinking of particle formation to days. The number of degrees of freedom in the system is quite staggering. And we've spent a great deal of time studying the various components just of this atmospheric system, the dynamics, the microphysics, the radiation, the radiative transfer through this medium of clouds and aerosol particles, the aerosol chemistry, the aerosol formation processes, et cetera, et cetera, and all these feedbacks. So this is a system that is clearly a very complex one. However, sometimes we look at a satellite image and we see that in spite of all this complexity, there does appear to be some kind of underlying, I don't want to say simplicity because this is far from a simple picture, but this is a system that seems to have certain preferred modes. We have closed cellular structure over here. We have open cellular structure over here. If I zoom in for a second, you'll see that more clearly. This is your closed cellular structure, and this is your open cellular structure. These are very similar to Rayleigh-Bernard cells, or at least an atmospheric analog to Rayleigh-Bernard convection. You're seeing patterns and emergence coming out of this complex aerosol cloud precipitation system. And when we saw this, we thought that there were some ways that we might want to explore in trying to reduce the degrees of freedom of the system and trying to understand some of this underlying, if not simplicity, at least understand the emergent properties. Well, here are just a few other simple examples from natural systems. Flock behavior. Here's a flock of birds all following a certain pattern. There is no single bird telling the birds, other birds, how to fly. All these birds are engaging in certain rules of engagement, and those rules essentially give you certain patterns. For the chemists amongst you, the very famous Belousov-Jabotinsky chemical reactions will give you some very interesting oscillatory patterns, and this is just a numerical simulation of those reactions. Some numerical simulations we've done in detailed cloud models showing that we can get these closed cellular structures and these open, somewhat hexagonal-looking structures in numerical simulations, as I said. And some of you, the students, saw this example of miso soup. You can get this just really easily. I did this. I'm not an experimentalist. I even attempted this just put a bowl of miso, make a bowl of miso soup. You'll get the closed structures, and you'll get the open structures at some point too. Anyhow, I'm going to talk a little about emergence. This is a concept that many of you are probably well familiar with. This is a very new field to me. Just the last couple of years, I've been dabbling in it. As I say, I came from that very detailed complexity worldview. Let's understand all the detailed processes. Emergence, system-wide patterns emerging from local interactions between elements that make up that system. So if you like, the flock of birds are all interacting. Those are the local interactions. There is an emergent behavior. That's the flock behavior. And the implication, at least the one that we're going to try to explore, is that complex problems with huge number of degrees of freedom might be amenable to solution with a much simpler set of equations. So to start off with, let's just take the example of Rayleigh-Bernard convection. The Rayleigh-Bernard convection just depicted here with this colored field. When you have a temperature gradient, two plates separated by with a temperature gradient separated by a distance h, above a certain critical Rayleigh number that depends on delta t h cubed, we're going to get a transition from conduction to convection. And what that means, at least in the lab situation, is that above this critical Rayleigh number over here, so this is the Rayleigh number as a function of wave number, or if you like, scale, above this critical Rayleigh number, we're going to have a range of allowable scales, or a range of allowable patterns, if you like. So these are different patterns, paper from Gettling and Brausch, showing different patterns that you can get in a lab setup of Rayleigh-Bernard convection. Each one of these experiments has a different set of parameters. Sometimes the plates are moved, sometimes you've got rotation of plates, but you can get amazing patterns emerging in these Rayleigh-Bernard convective experiments. But it's clear that in this range of allowable scales, there's certain preferred modes, and that's what I'd like to, preferred modes and patterns, and that's what I'd like to explore a little bit. So here again, we've got some satellite images on the left, closed cellular structures, just randomly selected from some satellite imagery, open cellular structures over here. You can see these somewhat hexagonal patterns over here and the closed cellular structures here. We ran a numerical simulation, which includes a great deal of complexity and detail. It, for those who care, it's the Wharf model. It's got two-moment microphysics. It's as large a domain as we could possibly squeeze. We've got grid sizes that are a little larger than we'd like, but they still capture what we were interested in. So 300 meters in the horizontal, 30 meters in the vertical. And we're looking at two simulations over here, which started with the identical initial conditions. No difference in the sounding, no difference in the boundary conditions. The only difference here was in the top simulation, we had a high aerosol input, so lots of particles going into this system, whereas down here, we had a low aerosol concentration. Now, from that very brief course I gave you, this system over here is more apt to generate precipitation, and this system over here is not going to precipitate at all or have very little precipitation. So it's clear that the precipitation is changing the structure of this, or the pattern in the system. And what's interesting here is that the aerosol particles are able to select the state of the system, all else equal. So if I took the same meteorology, just changing the aerosol is helping the system select which state or which pattern it wants to be in. The other thing that I think is really interesting is that this stable state over here, this open cellular state, is oscillating. What do I mean by oscillating? Well, really what I mean is it's rearranging. By the way, there's no wind. We took out the mean winds over here. So any rearrangement of these cells over here is caused by internal interactions in the system. The system is clearly not static. Regions that are bright end up becoming dark, and then bright again and dark again. So this is constantly rearranging itself, unlike the lab setup where you set up your experiment, got a fixed structure, and that was a steady state structure. Well, this is reminiscent to those who followed cloud physics of the Baker and Charlson study in 1990, where they identified two stable states using a very different approach. The stable states are identified as A and B. So on the x-axis here, we have the aerosol concentration. In this case, we've used the terminology cloud condensation nuclei, but this is essentially the aerosol concentration. So these are those clean conditions where you have lots of precipitation. That is one preferred mode. That's that drizzling open cell mode. And here we've got the closed cellular structure, the non-drizzling mode, and then this transition between them. So just trying to connect to older literature for those who are familiar with it. Now, let's look at the evolution. I showed you that movie before showing you how you would transition from one state to another. Here is just an example in three frames so you can focus in a little bit more carefully. I've labeled three convergence points. So, all right, what are we looking at here? We're looking at the vertical velocity field. So the upward motions between these two plates, if you like, or the surface and the boundary layer top. This is x, y, so this is a plan view near the surface of the vertical motions. Where you see red, you are seeing updraft, so air moving upwards, and where you see these blue colors, you're seeing downward moving air. If you follow these numbers, 1, 2, or 3, it might be easiest just to follow number 1. You can see that number 1 is a very strong convergence zone. It essentially has three adjacent cells, and so at this point, number 1, you've got a lot of air converging, and you've got very strong convection. Well, that strong convection very quickly starts to generate a deep cloud. Well, deep clouds tend to generate rain, and rain starts to generate downward moving air, evaporative cooling, and downward moving air. So you see how a strongly convergent zone ends up becoming a downward moving divergent zone, and you see that a new cell opens up at that point. So what was a convergent zone becomes a divergent cell zone. And if you followed many of these points, you would see very similar behavior. Clouds are buoyant regions, strongly convergent. Buoyant regions generate rain. Rain kills buoyancy and creates divergent regions. And you could see then how these patterns could start shifting. So in this little schematic over here, here is that strongly convergent region that's fed by divergence from adjacent cells where it's raining. And you could see how that could then, that thick cloud could start raining, driving a downward moving pattern. Well, that's a schematic. If you want to look at it in another form, here's just an idealized view of this. Hexagons, just to approximate all of this. The strong convergent regions are these red dots. The divergent regions are blue. And so these are those strong convergent regions being fed by adjacent downdrafts. And if I were to turn these convergence points into divergence points because of rainfall, you could see how that pattern could shift. And I'm just flipping back and forth between those to demonstrate the rearrangement. I've called it oscillation in the past. It's more of a rearrangement of these cells. Here's another way of looking at it. Here's a simple 2D model, Navier-Stokes equations, time on this axis over here. And here is your transition from conduction to convection. So you set up a convective pattern. Temperature over here on this y-axis or this axis here. You can see the convective pattern setting up. And what we did then is we perturbed them. So wherever we had strong convective patterns, we gave them a little bit of a perturbation in the form of negative buoyancy. Now this system is robust. And so even though the system sort of shook around that particular state, we still maintained essentially positive buoyancy, negative between them. But if we gave a strong enough perturbation in the form of strong rain, you can see how the strong positively buoyant regions start to alternate. And you can see a shifting back and forth with time between positively buoyant and negatively buoyant, just trying to simulate the effects of rainfall. Okay, one thing that we found particularly fascinating was when we looked at a time series of the precipitation for the entire system. That's P on the y-axis as a function of time. I've added in some other simulations. The ones I've shown you up till now have been the red ones. So if you like, focus just on the red curve. But it's clear that we've got a certain oscillation or periodicity in the rain rate. And that appears in some of the other numerical simulations we've done. So all of this system-wide behavior, all these oscillations and interactions between adjacent clouds have somehow given us some oscillation in the precipitation pattern. And if we start cutting that in different ways by just looking at a limited part of the domain as a function of time, we can see oscillations in the rain rate there as well. Focusing just on the red now, if we took a limited period of time and just looked at things spatially for a certain part of the domain, again, you see this periodic behavior in the precipitation rate. And if you put that all together in what the meteorologists call a Hofmüller diagram, so this is the spatial dimension here. We've had some averaging in the y direction, and this is time on this axis. You can see this gridded structure. So what's clear over here is that we don't have a random distribution in the rain. So, sorry, these bright spots over here are essentially showing us where the rain is. You can see that there is some kind of a gridded structure. So if I take a ruler here marked off with tick marks, you can see how with time, as time advances in this direction, you can see that these main peaks are shifting back and forth. Again, just trying to reinforce this notion of the pattern shifting back and forth as positively convergent buoyant regions become negatively buoyant. All right, so as the system constantly changes, that's not good. Let's see if I can do that. As the system constantly rearranges itself, and you've seen that image before, take a look at what's happening to the liquid water in this cloud. This you could see is a proxy for the rain. This is what the system is doing. It's clearly not random rain occurring in certain parts of the domain. Clearly there's some kind of a pulsation in the system, some kind of a periodicity. And that's what I was showing on those previous plots. This is just a visual of what those previous time series or Hofmüller diagrams were showing, that the system has a certain frequency to it, and that there is some kind of synchronization between these cells. It's obviously not perfectly synchronized by any means, but there is communication going on within the system so that rain forms and then dissipates and forms again and dissipates. And so the question that we raised was, well, do we see these oscillating patterns very often? And again, we went back to our very detailed models, our large eddy simulations, where we take a gridded structure in three dimensions and we look at drop size distributions and aerosol particle sizes, and we put all the detail we possibly can into them. And we looked at a time series of cloud water, that would be the solid line, and rain in the dashed line. We found that we saw this interesting periodic behavior again. So this periodicity in the rain rate is not chance. And here we're seeing it along with periodicity in the cloud water. And if you look at this time series, you see how the cloud water tends to build up. And sometime after the cloud water has reached a maximum, the rain follows. I think we can all intuitively understand that. Clouds outside will tend to thicken. As they thicken and get darker, the rain falls. These are fairly obvious, perhaps. But when you get caught up in the details, you don't think of parameterizing it with such simplicity. Here, we just look at a phase diagram of rain on the y-axis, cloud water on the x-axis, and we follow these anti-clockwise loops. And it goes, this is essentially the same information shown in the time series in a phase diagram. And when we saw that, we thought, well, and of course this too brought to mind the predator-prey model, the Lotka-Volterra equations that come from the field of population dynamics. And here, too, we have a population of rabbits. So this would be our prey. Rabbits are the food for foxes. The rabbit population grows and thrives. At that point, the foxes have plenty of food. They prey on the rabbits. The fox population grows. But the foxes are now depleting the rabbit population. That pulls down the rabbit population. Now there's less food for the foxes, and so on and so forth. And you can see how you essentially have these two populations that are offset from one another. Two very simple nonlinear equations that are quite fascinating. So again, we're trying to apply this predator-prey model to the cloud rain problem. In our case, clouds are the rabbits, so clouds are the prey, and rain is the foxes. So rain is preying on the clouds. This is interesting because clouds are producing rain in the first place. So clouds are producing the predator that then preys upon them. So this is just an interesting way of looking at this problem, but I hope to persuade you that there's some relevance here. So clouds build up, the rain follows some time behind, rain destroys the cloud regenerates. Why does the cloud regenerate? Well, the meteorology or the convection wants to create a cloud over there, or perhaps you've got some interaction of adjacent outflows that are helping to regenerate clouds where they just disappeared. Is this even realistic? I think we all, as I said, intuitively know that clouds thicken and then rain follows. This is a radar image, a cloud radar showing you essentially the same idea. You can see how the cloud top rises. These reddish, brownish colors over here are showing you strong radar reflectivity, or essentially precipitation. You can see how first the cloud thickens, so the cloud depth rises, and it's only at some point that you start getting the rain coming down to the surface, at which point the cloud thins. So this is just one simple illustration of what I was showing you before. Well, we built some simple balance equations. These are not the Lotka-Volterra or predator-prey equations. These are our own balance equations, but they're similar ideas. First of all, H will be the cloud depth, or if you like, there's a sense here of how much water is in that cloud, the column thickness of that cloud. We have a carrying capacity term, which is essentially telling us to what depth that cloud would grow in a few timescales, tau 1. And then we have a loss term. Here's the loss term due to rain. And there's a delay over here because it takes time for clouds to grow into raindrops. This is common in biological systems. You need time to maturation before you can generate, in this case, the rain. Now, when it comes to the rain, we did some experiments where we had a second differential equation for the rain rate. So very similar growth to a formation term and a loss term. However, we've got a lot of empirical and theoretical evidence that suggests that a diagnostic equation might be an easier way to go. I chose over here to show the diagnostic version of this. And so we diagnose the rain rate based on this function with a delay time. But we add a third differential equation for the drop concentration. Now, remember, the drop concentration is determined by the aerosol particle concentration. And because that drop concentration or aerosol concentration is so important for determining whether a cloud will rain or not, we felt we couldn't just fix this value because it's something of a cascading process. As that number reduces, you're going to get stronger and stronger rain. And so we solved a second differential equation for the drop concentration. Again, it has a carrying capacity term, and then it has this loss term due to rain. The loss terms I won't spend time on, but we formulated the loss terms over here for the cloud depth. So it's dependent on the drop concentration. You could see why we would want to solve a second differential equation for the drop concentration. And then the loss term for the drop concentration depends on the rain rate. So the coupling is clear between these three equations. So here again are those three equations: cloud depth, rain rate diagnosed, drop concentration. 1, 2, 4, 5 different parameters over here. The two carrying capacity terms, two time constants for recharge of the system, and a delay time for the time that it takes for cloud water to convert to rainwater. Well, here are just a few simple simulations that will give you a sense of what you get from these, and then I'll try to show you some other behaviors that I think are interesting. We get, in this case, after a few cycles, So here's the time series. Red is the drop concentration. Black solid is the cloud depth, and the dashed line is the rain rate. The cloud depth builds up. At some point, the rain builds up, depletes the cloud of water, and very quickly we get into some steady state. And this is a steady state where we can see how this system could coexist. Here we are at our in our limit cycle, well, not in our equilibrium point over here, at a certain rain rate and cloud depth, or at a certain drop concentration and cloud depth. And that's the steady state solution. We ran these for 7 days, but in most of these cases, we tend to achieve some kind of equilibrium very quickly. Steady state, we were also able to calculate very simply from by setting the cloud depth, DHDT equal to zero, we can get the steady state cloud depth and look at the behavior of that system. And this was quite interesting because we get a very simple quadratic equation. And when we look at the cloud depth, so these contours are the steady state cloud depth in drop concentration and H naught carrying capacity for the meteorology or the cloud depth space, we see this very clear separation again into these two regimes. This regime over here is where the cloud depth is determined by the drop concentration to a large degree. So these lines are starting to become more and more parallel with drop concentration. So just adding some aerosol particles will help sustain clouds of a certain depth. Increasing that will give you deeper clouds. This part of the regime, we are in highly polluted areas with lots of drops, and here the cloud depth is determined primarily by the H-naught parameter. So that's where the meteorology or the ability of that system to generate thick clouds is going to completely drive this system. And again, it's similar to the Baker and Charlson separation into these two different modes. Here is the non-drizzling state. Here is the drizzling state. Each one of them with different sensitivity to the system parameters. One more example where we increased the H-naught parameter. So here we've got a lot more meteorology driving thicker clouds. And actually, we also increased fairly significantly the N-naught parameter or the aerosol population, or else we got a very unstable system. Here you can see these much wilder oscillations that go on. And in fact, after 7 days, we have achieved this kind of limit cycle here in the cloud depth number world, or the black would be the cloud depth rain world. So this oscillation goes on to a point where it just keeps going. And it's rather unstable, I will say. This brings to mind questions of stability, robustness of the system. How stable are these stable states? Again, those are your two stable states from the Baker and Charlson work or from our work. The question is, I'm showing a Lorentz-style diagram over here, not to point out rapid transition between attractors, but thinking of the robustness, how robust are these states? So, for example, how robust is that closed cellular state, and how robust is the open cellular state? How readily do we transition between them? Because that has a lot of implication for this for the climate world. Now, as you probably all know, small perturbations tend to strengthen the resilience of self-organized systems. And so what I did is I took those same two simulations that I showed you before and perturbed them with some fairly strong perturbations very regularly and showed that these solutions are robust. Actually, what was even more interesting was that this system over here is now even more robust than it was over here. So adding some perturbation, you can see that because now we've converged to the area occupied by this open area is now diminished quite significantly. So the system now is more robust than it was in its original state just by the addition of perturbations. Now, of course, if I perturb that system strongly enough or regularly enough, it would collapse and I would reach a regime where I could no longer sustain a cloud. Another interesting thing I thought was, for those familiar with the Rosenzweig paradox, this very interesting paper talks about the more food that you provide your system, in our case, the larger the H-naught, the larger the carrying capacity, the more unstable it will be. So here was an example where we went from 530 meters to 670. We got a much more unstable system, and we had to add a significantly larger number of aerosol particles to actually keep it somewhat stable. So you could see these aerosol particles as being something of a stabilizing agent or an immunizer to the system. Okay, so I've got just a little bit more, and I thought that I'd jump into this idea of synchronization of coupled oscillators. You've seen this movie before, and I'll just run it very briefly again. You saw this sort of pulsation in the system, the fact that you don't have random precipitation occurring in parts of the domain, but there's some kind of communication going on over here. And so for me, this brought to mind, just from my limited reading of the subject, synchronization in coupled systems, some of the work done by Kuramoto, Winfrey, and Vina as well. And Kuramoto talks about these three different modes. One is where you have no oscillation. You've got a population that's way too diverse. Every piece of is not communicating across the system, and you've got no oscillation at all. Another where you've got an oscillation where the less diverse population is oscillating in sync, but the rest is not oscillating at all. And then, of course, if you have a homogeneous enough population, then all the components would be perfectly synced. And I'd like to try to persuade you that we're in this mode of number two, where we've got a certain amount of synchronized oscillation. At least part of the system is synchronized, and the rest is not. A few simple equations from the Kuramoto model. The global coupling is occurring through this mean phase of the system over here, psi. So we've got I individual oscillators. This is the equation for an individual oscillator, the phase of an individual oscillator, frequency, coupling parameter k, and r is the phase coherence. And the idea here is that you've got coupling of all these individual oscillators, through the mean field phase and this coherence parameter r. And you get a positive feedback. So slowly you start entraining. Whoop. That's US government requirements. Slowly you start entraining some of these oscillators into the mean phase of the system, and you start getting coupling that's more pervasive. So you're pulling these individual oscillators into the mean phase psi, depending on the strength of the coupling and the magnitude of the phase coherence. So another couple of diagrams from Stephen Strogatz's paper in 2000. You can see how as this phase coherence R increases, as time increases, you get an increase in the phase coherence if, here when K is greater than some critical coupling strength. Or if you like, when K is greater than this coupling strength, you can see your phase coherence jumping up fairly abruptly. So what have I done? I've played around. This is very new work. I'm sure this will raise some eyebrows. I'm thinking of clouds here as individual oscillators. Excuse me, Roland, I have to apologize. Individual clouds are oscillators. Clouds grow, they thicken, they precipitate, they disappear. The meteorology or the convection creates a new cloud there. And I'm trying to view this system of open cellular structure as a system of coupled oscillators. I've taken just a linear view of this. It's a lot easier to do with my numerical calculations. So what we could see here is if this cloud is growing, not precipitating. Precipitating clouds are decreasing in depth. Clouds that are growing would be the ones that have convergence into them. And I've got a coupling strength, which I've called eta. And this is the coupling that's coming from the existence of adjacent clouds that are precipitating. If I had divergence, here, of course, the same thing. I mean, I'm just repeating. This cloud is decaying. DHDT is less than zero. And now I've got divergence to the surface feeding into this cloud, which is growing. And so I took the predator-prey equations, and now I've done them for N-coupled oscillators. So the same equations, but now with a subscript I, the same carrying capacity, growth term, the same rain, depletion term, but these extra coupling terms. And you can see that I've also added in a delay time because it's going to take time for the rain that's occurring some distance away to manifest as downdrafts, divergence, and then convergence into the cloud I'm interested in. I again solve an equation for each oscillator for the drop concentration and diagnose rain. Well, just very briefly, here are 21 oscillators. I didn't have any coupling here at all. I got a rather boring solution. I'm just showing it here because it very rapidly converges within way less than a day. Just some flat lines, and it looks a little bit boring. The different lines are just for different oscillators. I'm sticking with the previous color convention of red being drop concentration, black being cloud depth, dashed being rain. And here's the phase diagram. Each one of these oscillators, not communicating with the other, just goes into its steady state mode. And there are the different steady state points. I did this very recently. I made a mistake. I used a coupling parameter that's positive. And if you go back to those original equations, you can see that the coupling parameter should actually be negative because I don't want adjacent clouds to be, adjacent clouds are only going to feed into me if they're in a decaying stage. They're not going to feed into me if they're growing. So my first simulation was an error, and it's an error in the sense that it's not relevant to clouds, but I think it is kind of interesting because if you look at this jumble over here of curves, you can see the only point I want to show here is there's no phase coherence whatsoever initially. But if you wait long enough after a day, and time over here is all relative. I don't have my time scales necessarily true to true meteorological systems. But if you wait long enough and just pick out the red lines over here, that would be good enough. I think I could persuade you that there's coherence in the system after waiting one day. So you've gone from a very non-coherent system to some coherence after a day. Again, the phase diagram over here. I'm only showing 9 of the 21 oscillators, or it just gets really messy. And then this was my real attempt at trying to get this right with the correct sign on my coupling parameter, pointing to the fact that these clouds are feeding into this one. So if you think of it now, all the even oscillators should eventually be synced, and all the odd oscillators should be synced, not the adjacent ones. This is from 7 to 10 days, and if you look at this point, by the way, I've changed my color coding here. Red now is for the odd oscillators and even for the black. So forget the previous color scheme. Just look at the red oscillators. Here is at one point at 7.73 days. You can see that the peaks are sometimes aligned, so we've got some phase coherence, but down here it's pretty clear that we don't have all of these oscillators in phase. So the odd oscillators are not all in phase, and the same is true of the even ones. So if you line up on the black ones, the even oscillators, some are in phase and some are not. But if we then proceed a few days later, we've now got a state. This red line is again for the odd ones. All the odd oscillators are now phase locked, and all the even oscillators are phase locked. Their amplitudes are different. That's not the point, really. We know they're going to have different amplitudes. You can see the clusters over here at different amplitudes, but they are all in phase. And so this is just a simple way of taking the system-wide behavior. The initial predator-prey was the entire system. How do the clouds build up and how does the rain form for that entire domain? And here I've tried to break this down into individual cloud components in the system interacting with one another and somehow producing some coupled oscillations. All right, I'm going to wrap up. What's the way forward? This probably speaks to some of you here. We've spent a lot of time on the process level understanding, following the reductionist Newtonian approach, trying to understand all the microphysics and all the detail, which is definitely something we should continue to pursue. In John Hart's view, John Hart, Physics Today, there's also the systems approach. Let's think of the system-wide behavior, the emergent behavior, and let's start trying to merge the Newtonian and the Darwinian views. So my one slide summary, I've tried to explore in this complex aerosol cloud system the idea of emergence, coherent patterns emerging from local interactions in the system. We looked at these open and closed cellular structures as an example of emergence in a cloud system. Other examples were the flock behavior or that chemical reaction that I showed simulations of. A question I raise is, can we exploit emergence to represent complex systems? Perhaps climate models may be able to do that. We went into the open cellular state and looked at this coupled system that's constantly rearranging itself. In this case, the local interactions are the convergence or divergence of the precipitating outflows. So that's the communication that's going on in this distributed system. The outcome of that was a somewhat synchronized rain, not perfectly by any means, and oscillations in this open cellular state. It's constantly rearranging itself as we convert positive buoyancy to negative buoyancy. And then we looked at that in terms of the coupled oscillators, the Kuramoto model. And so, you know, and then finally, the predator-prey problem, I think, shows some of the aerosol cloud precipitation interactions. I think that we should try to exploit that, and I'll leave it at that.